Okay, this week is both Parshas Tzav and Shabbos Hagadol, and let's try to maybe see some overlapping themes between them. So we are focusing on the fourth Aliyah today, and the fourth Aliyah, a few minutes ago we were talking about graduation. This is kind of the graduation ceremony, or the Chag HaSmicha, for the Kohanim. And Rashi tells us that this is because of Ein Mukdam Uchar B'Torah, so it's not necessarily in order, but this parsha is said 7 days before the Hakamas HaMishkan, Rashi points out. And on the second pasuk, the first pasuk tells us, V'edaber Hashem Moshe Lemor, so God tells to Moshe, Kach es Aaron v'yazbanav ito, v'yaz ha-begodim, v'yaz shem ha-mishcha, v'yaz parachatas, v'yaz shem ha-eirim, v'yaz ha-matzos. So you should take Aaron and his sons, and also all of these components that will be a part of this process here. So what does kach mean? So we've been talking recently about coercion. So does this mean that they get schlepped against their will? So Rashi tells us about the language kach, kachenu b'dvaru mashrehu. You should speak to them in a way that will convince them to come. The Sifsei Chamim has a comment over here that this is actually a whole different word. It doesn't come from the language of kicha. It doesn't come from a language meaning take. By contrast, the Malbim does connect it to the general kicha language that we have, but he compares it to usage we find, for example, when it comes to lulav. So we are told to do a mitzvah of kicha, and there, part of the din is that it has to be without any chatzitza, without any interruption in between. So to here, it means that we should grab them by the heart. In other words, you should convince them, you should entice them, and that's the lashon of kicha here. Chazal have a comment regarding these psukim, which we've touched upon before, but it's worth repeating, especially because it's mentioned again in this context also, that the Gemara in Zvachim, Adaf Peches and Midbeis, in reference to these begadim and these karbanos, says, why is it that there's a smicha of karbanos to Bigdei Kahuna in order to make that point that both are mechaper? And again, we said a few weeks ago, and again, it's worth repeating, that we have that opportunity even Bizman Hazak, that even though we don't have the karbanos or the Bigdei Kahuna, but we are able to learn about them, and the notion actually of neshama parim svasenu, that there is a kiyum, and learning about the korbanos as if one actually brings the korbanos is derived from Sukkim and Parshas Tzav, so among other places, so that's also a parsha relevant theme. But also we should note that the idea of a kapara is something that we can tap into without even having to look to any kind of mystical ideas or any chidusha and halacha, but rather that the kapara on one level comes from being able to focus on certain values that the begadim or the kohanim or the korbanos represent. So we are still able to do that. And we'll do that even more pointedly when we're not looking to fulfill the details of the mitzvah in practice, because we don't have that opportunity. So we are then focused more on the theory. And the idea that there's an imagery in the Bigdei Kahuna that, and in the korbanos, that allow us to attain a kapara because it helps us to reorient our thinking and to focus on certain values. So that's 100% available to us, and once again, that is something that is an extra mila of learning about these things. Okay, so the next pasuk tells us, V'eis kol ha'ida ha'ke'el el pesach ho'homoi. So here, something which seems impossible, the instruction is to take the whole Jewish people and gather them by the Pesach HaHomoi. So here Rashi again quotes from the Taurus Konim, the Rig Rabba, Ze'echa ben ha-mekomo shehichzik mu'at es ha-meruba. That this is one of the places where we find that there's apparently some kind of miracle in defiance of the laws of physics, and a small space, we're talking about that also before we started, a small space is able to hold on to a big crowd. And the Ibn Ezra explains that even though we have that comment as something miraculous, but he understands maybe it's talking about the heads of the Shvatim, so that could have been more practically conceivable. But the Taurus Konim, as the Taurus Yuma notes, says what it does because there's an apparent question here of how was this possible mathematically. So apparently it was a miracle. So then the question is, we assume that every miracle has a purpose, because Baruch Hu doesn't do miracles for no reason. So what's the point of the miracle here? So the Lutz Gerav talks about this in the Yisnayim Torah, and he writes that this is to give an example of Tzimtzum, of the whole idea that HaKadosh Baruch Hu contracts himself, Kaviyachol, so that he can live within the Mishkan. So we want to be able to picture that. So here we are shown this image of contraction of Tzimtzum, and that is what is able to help us envision what's going on. Another possibility is that it's to symbolize Achdus, so to make everyone come together in a way that seems impossible. So maybe nowadays we also think that Achdus in the other sense is impossible. How could you bring people together? So if you can bring people physically together in a space that doesn't hold them, so then perhaps even emotionally it's possible as well. And that's an interesting concept overall, because you find here some references to the idea that people will be in closer proximity, so they will therefore be able to get along better. Even though we normally say the opposite, when people don't have room and don't have space, sometimes that's what gets them more disturbed and angry at each other and not able to tolerate their presence, and their gemaras that sound like that as well. But it could be that it's maybe a synergistic point here, to use one of our favorite words, that when people get along better, so then they can tolerate sharing a more confined space. So maybe it's a part of a cyclical effect here, and maybe that's perhaps a part of the imagery. Others suggest that this is also, maybe the Lashon HaTorah also has this, that because we assume that the Kohanim are Shluchei Didan, that Kohanim are emissaries of the Jewish people, and that the Gemara has a discussion in Kedushin and elsewhere, whether we say Hani Kohanei Shluchei D'Rachmaninu, or Hani Kohanei Shluchei D'Daninu, are the Kohanim acting as representatives of God, or representatives of the Jews to God. Apparently the name Kashmin is a name of Kahuna. And my father told me once that the idea is that it's Rashi Tavis. Whatever opinion in the Gemara you take, if Rashi Tavis worked either way, that Kashdan stands for Kone Shluchei Rachmana Ninu, or Kone Shluchei Didan Ninu. But if we say that they are our Shluchim, so then we had to all be a part of this Chinuch process, so the whole Jewish nation has to be there. Now, the Torah Tumimah also suggests, in light of the Ibn Ezra's explanation, that it's about the heads of the Shvatim, that being that this was the appointment of Aaron as the Kohen Gadol, so therefore we need a Sanhedrin to convey the appointment, and that role could also be filled by the heads of the Shvatim, as the Yerushalmi suggests in the first parak of Sanhedrin. The Netziv understood that everyone is there because, as we said before, that it's all like their korban, and when your korban is brought, you want to be there to be present for that. Or maybe he suggests another interesting idea, that it refers to the Talmidei Chachamim, and that perhaps this is a part of conveying what Torah Shebaal Peh is, because as he notes, and we'll see again in a second, that there are some differences from how it is articulated here and what Moshe is actually doing. So Moshe is displaying the power of Torah Shebaal Peh. The fact is that there's an oral tradition also that becomes a crucial part of the transmission, and the Talmidei Chachamim will see this and he'll explain that that's how it works. So therefore this is an opportunity to convey that power of Torah Shebaal Peh. So in any event, so Vayas Moshe Kashiv Siva Hashem also says the next pasuk, and what happens? But he koil ha'ed al pesach ha'homoi. So here Moshe follows the instructions, and what happens? And the Eda gathers itself. It sounds like it's passive language here. And this is a topic that was discussed by Bezalel Radinsky, one of his sichos printed in the Sefer Mishkan Bezalel. And he notes the Gemara Masechet Brachos in the first parak on Daf Vav Amud Beis. The Gemara has a statement that kol adam sheyesh bo yiras shamayim dvarim nishmayim, a person who represents yiras shamayim, so his words are heard, which also sounds like a passive kind of reality, that it's not necessarily about him having to instruct people, but people learn from what you do. So the person's intentions and thoughts are heard, so to speak, without him necessarily having to spell them out. That's a madrega. People learn from your actions. And there's a similar point that was made by Reb Nevensal in one of his sichos. He has a long sicha all about this point, and then a little long sicha about this aliyah based on this idea. And he talks about the notion of chinuch and how chinuch is normally understood as training others and instructing others, but chinuch really starts at home. And chinuch is also about the process that one does of educating himself and constantly working and growing himself, and that Mimela is also going to have an effect on the people around you. And that's, once again, a synergistic idea, that one continues to grow and to refine his own behavior, and that process is impressive, and that's going to be something that other people are going to learn from, and that's where true chinuch comes from. Lubavitcher Rebbe had a similar comment in the Lashon of Chazal in the Pasuk, in the beginning of Emor, when the Chazal darshan a Pasuk to mean that this responsibility of the adults towards the children in terms of keeping them from averos and the like and training them in mitzvos. So the language of Chazal is lahazir gedolim ala ketanim. So the literal translation, you understand that to mean to instruct, to warn the adults regarding the children. But he had a more homiletic understanding that the language of lahazir is like zohar, is to glow, then if the parents glow, so then the children see that, and they're impressed, and that has an effect on them. So that's where genuine chinuch is really going to be accomplished, and that's perhaps a part of what's being suggested here. The reference to the Pesach Ol Moed, so the Tosefta in Megillah, in the third parak, has a comment that you see from here that the Tzibor and the Chazan are all facing front. So Torah Tumimah's notes here, it's hard a little bit to see how we can read that from the Pasuk specifically, but one way or another, the point is being made here that the structure of Tefillah B'Tzibor, so we don't have the Chazan performing for the Tzibor so that he's turning around and everyone's watching him like he's a singer, but rather he's facing front, just standing in the front of the room, but facing the same direction as the Tzibor is, because that's the idea. He's a shliach of the Tzibor. He's representing them, he's an emissary of them, so therefore he's one of them standing in front and facing the same direction. It's interesting, there's a similar idea that comes up when we consider the question of the chasana and where the chasana and kala face. So there were some who felt very strongly that the chasana and kala should also be facing front, should be facing the same direction as the kihila. There are those who felt more strongly that it should be the other way around, that you should have the tzibur facing the chasan and kala. So the chasan and kala are looking out towards the audience. And some went so far as to say that that is actually necessary to avoid the chukas agayim, because in the church weddings, so you have it the other way around, the priest is facing the audience and facing the chasan and kala, the bride and the groom also. So it's not just a detail. The reason they take it so seriously is because it goes to the understanding of what's going on, which is a little bit related, somewhat synergistic, a little bit related to our whole topic of getting this year, and the reason that the process is specifically about the husband giving his wife a get, and it's not something that is imposed by Beis Din or by society in general, because there's this fundamental difference in structure between a Jewish wedding on the one hand and a church wedding and a civil wedding on the other hand, that in a church wedding or a civil wedding, so the priest is marrying the couple, or in a civil wedding, the judge or the justice of the peace is marrying the couple. But in the Jewish wedding, it doesn't work that way. The rabbi is not actually marrying the couple. He's only supervising. And the chassan is marrying the kala with her consent. So they're the stars of the show. So the idea being, so then the formation of the room should reflect that everyone's watching them. And the rabbi is also watching them. He's not facing the audience. He's not the one who's the star of the show. He's just observing like they are, but he's observing from closer up, because that's his role, to be a supervisor, to make sure everything goes right. Hi.
Is there any, like, in this whole direction thing, because during tefillah we face forward, because, right, Aaron and Yerushalayim, should there be something like that also with the wedding, that there, that the
there are some who have a kepeda like that. Yeah, you don't know, most places I don't think they're,
but we like flip the whole,
but there are system. There are people who have a kepeda. I don't think it's a very common kepeda, but it has been brought up. Hi.
Well, the chatan and kala are also the stars of the wedding.
Very good. So it depends how they're doing it, actually. Though nowadays, we don't do it that way, but theoretically, they could be the stars.
I would have said the ksuba is the star of the wedding.
Right, the ksuba. But that's also a little bit misleading, because the ksuba is the star being used with the wedding, but we shouldn't confuse that with kedushei star. So maybe that would be a little bit misleading. Okay, so moving on. So the next pasuk tells us, "V'yomer Moshe al Ha'ida zeh ha'davar asher tziva Hashem la'asos." So here the Torah tells us that Moshe says, this is the thing that God commanded us to do. So what does that represent? So here, Rashi explains, "Varim shetiru shani os lefnechem tzivani HaKadosh Baruch Hu la'asos v'al tomer l'chvaydu l'chvarachi ani osa." So you could think that, okay, I'm making a big deal out of this because my brother's involved and he's the star of the show. So maybe you think I'm going to make this into a bigger show for the kavod of my family, the kavod of myself. So he's emphasizing, no, this is how HaKadosh Baruch Hu commanded it. And the Nitziv, continuing the point we said before, that this is representative of the Torah Shabbat part, that there was differences in how it was carried out from the actual language of the Pasuk. So therefore, Moshe explained to them, you should understand that I'm not deviating, but this is the thing, this is what God commanded, and this is how I'm doing it. The Gemara in the Masechet Zuma and Daf Ches Amud Beis understands from here that you see that Dibur is Ma'akeh, that it had to be said out loud. And that's interesting because one could theoretically darshan from here a comparison to the notion of saying things out loud at the Seder, and also particularly the Rabban Gamliel and the Shlosh Dvarim that have to be recited. So there's some food for thought, food for thought, connect that to, or thought about food, I guess, to connect that regarding the Seder practices. But here, the notion that this is crucial, the Chavetzel Sasharim, a popular Sefer on Chumash for halachic discussions about the Parsha, Lomdish's questions about the Parsha, he has a lot to say. If you have that Sefer, if you don't have that Sefer, there's a whole set downstairs in the base medrash on the first floor in the back of the room. But it's a very, very thick Sefer. He has a lot of things to say about a lot of topics. And on this Aliyah, he has a lot. He has many, many, many pages, so more than we could be representing today, but feel free to go downstairs and take a look. So he talks about this idea also of Dibor being Ma'akev. And he writes that it's different from, say, Chalitza. He says, here the recitation is part of the process. And that's why he notes that sometimes we have the Kepeda, that we say, Dvarim Shebichsav, Ein Omrim Bal Peh, that if something is from the Torah, it's supposed to be said specifically from the Ksav. So here, Chikri Leib and his Chuvis notes that that's a requirement specifically in Talmud Torah. And here, this is a part of the process, so he suggests that we wouldn't be worried about it in this context. So the next pasuk tells us, V'yakri of Moshe, Es Aaron V'es Bonav, okay, so they were washed. And the next pasuk tells, "Vayiten olav es hakutones ve'achgoroso ba'avnei ve'alveshoso es hamil vayiten olav es ha'ifod ve'achgoroso ve'cheshu ve'ifod ve'yepod lo bo." So here it goes through the whole process of putting these begadim on. The language of vayiten olav, that he put it on him. So the Nitziv suggests that that's there just to show that this is equal, placing a garment on somebody is equal to wearing it, and that has nafkaminas for hilchoshatnas, for example, and other things. And it sounds like from the pasuk that there's a specific order to how these are being put on. If you look at Rabbeinu Bachya and his comments here, so he discusses how this represents the different levels of shamayim, different levels of heaven. He goes into detail. There's some quite mystical points there. You can take a look. And the notion of there being a specific order, so it sounds, there are some who suggest that maybe this is specifically in the context of the Miluim, and not necessarily all the time, but the Rambam sounds like he records this for all the times. So that's a discussion that Briska Rav has in his Shiurim to Maseches Yuma. So this next pasuk, so here this is a milestone. This pasuk Ches, Avayasam es Hachoshen, El Hachoshen es Urim b'Satumim. So this pasuk telling us about the Urim b'Tumim is the halfway mark in Psukim. So there are a number of ways that the Torah is divided, so to speak, or there's a note when you reach the halfway part. There are three different ways. So this is the halfway mark in Psukim. There's another notation of where the halfway mark in letters is, and where the halfway mark in words. So if you look at the comments of Schwab and Sefer Mayan Beis HaShoeva, so he notes that All of these are ways of telling us about the concept of division. He has a drasha on each one. And here he suggests that coming in this context, it's a reference to the chagura, which is a division between the upper body and the lower body. And that's a way of creating a special space for Rukhmias separate from Gashmias, which is related to the idea of a gartel. So he suggests that that is perhaps what is connoted by this halfway mark taking place here. And we'll just make another point or two about the next pasuk, and then maybe say a few words about Shabbos HaGadol. So it continues, Vayikach Moshe as Hashem and HaMishcha, Vayimshach as HaMishcha, Vyevchal Asher Bo, Vayikadesh Osam, Vyazmen and Mizbech Shal Pamim, Vayimshach as Mizbech, as Kogor, as Kiyor, as Kano, as Kachon. So just to make a quick reference here, so Rav Nevensal has another essay on this aliyah, another sikha on this aliyah, which focuses on this time, on this point, and the idea of the Shemot HaMishcha, and he talks about the theme of preparation, and the idea that Mishcha comes from a language which has two meanings, which if he was saying it in English it would sound better, represents anointing and appointing, and that those themes come together here, and it helps to emphasize the role of preparation in Kedusha, and the idea that that is how Kedusha essentially is able to take place, through the process of preparation, and that's a big part of the theme, really, of this Aliyah as a whole, which is the segue into talking a little bit about Shabbos HaGadol. So here, a big part of this Aliyah and this Parsha is about the preparation for Gadlus, Kohen HaGadol Me'achav, and the whole notion of Kohanim in general. So the Shabbos, not because of that, but the Shabbos is known as Shabbos HaGadol, the Shabbos before Pesach. And there are many, many theories as to why it's called that. Where exactly does the name Shabbos HaGadol come from? Rabbi Chalap Zayin Gezunt was the rabbi in a shul for many, many decades. I remember telling me once that every year he would give a different reason for why it's called Shabbos HaGadol, and he never repeated himself. So there are many, many different theories as to what it's about. We're not going to go through every reason that Rabbi Chalap gave. I don't know all of them. But just to mention a few of the more well-known ones, probably the one that maybe is a little bit most likely, perhaps, is that usually when we have a Shabbos that has its own name, a special name that distinguishes it other than the Parsha name, so the name generally comes from the Haftorah. So Shabbos Shuva comes from the Haftorah, Shabbos Chazon, Shabbos Nachemu, all these names are based on the Haftorah, so that's presumably the case here, if not the opening word of the Haftorah, but it's a crucial theme that Yom HaGadol V'Hanorah, V'Heshev Le'Vavos Albanim V'Le'Banim Alavosam. So that is one of the very notable points in the Haftorah, and perhaps that's why the Shabbos gets its name. But there are a number of other reasons suggested. And the Medrash Rabba talks about the fact that here we have the Korban Pesach being prepared, and the Jews at this time, right before Pesach actually was, so they set aside the lamb on that Shabbos, and the firstborns of the Egyptians, so they gathered around, and they asked them what they were doing, and they responded, oh, don't worry, this is a Pesach offering to Kadosh Baruch Hu, who's going to kill the firstborn of the Mishnah. So that was certainly disturbing to them, and these firstborns then went to their fathers and to Pharaoh and say that they should be allowed to set the Jewish people free. But Pharaoh and the fathers still refused, and there was apparently a war between these firstborns and their authorities, and many of them were killed, and so this was another way of protecting the Jewish people and bringing about their liberation. So that is one type of godless, but perhaps maybe a little bit more well-known and a little bit more understandable, the point that the Torah makes, that here, considering what was going on, that there was a miracle on a different level, and maybe a bilateral miracle, that the Jews, being that they were setting aside a lamb now to bring, so that itself is very provocative to the Mitzrayim, because they worshipped the lamb. So to do this is an act of tremendous bravery, and also to a certain extent part of the point, part of the idea of bringing karbanos with certain animals is a way of displaying how not godly they are, that these animals that we worship are actually not the gods themselves and instead are offered to the actual god. And it's one of the reasons that Rambam writes in Maror Nebuchim for the theme of karbanos. I don't think we got a chance to talk about this so much this year, but the whole discussion is appropriate to the beginning of Sefer Vayikra of what is the role of karbanos. And as I often cited machlokas between the Rambam and the Ramban, that the Rambam seems to understand that karbanos are less inherently a focus and more there kind of as a reaction to the idolatrous nations. And he has at least two different ways of saying that, but one of the ways he says that is that these nations worship these animals, and we don't worship these animals, we instead sacrifice these animals to the one God that we do worship. So that's a theme in general, but specifically that's the case here. So despite this act of provocation, so they were able to survive, and the Mitzrim were unable to either say anything or lift a hand against them. So there's kind of a bilateral miracle there, that there is a miracle that the Jews were able to be so brave, and that's something we recognize, and also a miracle that they were not able to be hurt at the hands of the Mitzrim, who otherwise would have been very provoked. Caleb?
Could that have to do with why each nation brings a karban on Sukkot?
I mean, as an act of...
as an act of showing these things that aren't gods.
Maybe. It's an interesting suggestion.
Also interesting the fact that the karbanot that are brought... that one of the karbanot that's brought on Chagim is a bull. An ayil.
Mm-hmm.
That's a ram. One of the things that we bring on the Chagim is a bull, and that could atone for us with the Chet HaEgel, which we read about recently, about how we once worshipped a cow, and now we're bringing a cow as a karban to Hashem, showing that he's the master.
Well, we actually have that theme of the Miluim, so that definitely is an established theme. So, in any event, so in addition to this, the Pri Chodesh suggests that this is basically the first mitzvah that the Jews have to perform, because the mitzvah of Chodesh is Elohim is not something they were in a position to perform then, so this is basically the first mitzvah that they're actually doing as a nation. So, in a sense, this is basically like their bar mitzvah. This is how the nation becomes a gadol. This is how they attain adulthood, and therefore, perhaps for that reason, it's called gadol. The Chasam Sofer suggests that it's a reference to a tshuva, and therefore, that's a phase of gadlus, that is an acceptance of reaching a higher madrega. So the Jews who took this step towards turning towards God and doing tshuva is something that also gives a title of godless. And that's another suggestion. The one more suggestion, which we'll keep in mind for going on too much longer, is what Shiboli Hadleket acknowledges, that because of the Shabbos HaGadol Drasha, that the practices that the rabbi speaks on Shabbos HaGadol, back then, the practice was not necessarily the rabbi speaks every Shabbos, so the notion of a Shabbos HaGadol and Shabbos Shuva Drasha was they really had twice a year is when they had the drashos. So the rabbi tends to give a very long and drawn-out drasha, so it makes Shabbos feel very long. So it becomes a Shabbos HaGadol. I guess it also helps to contribute to that effect. If you just change the clock recently, and it's a long day with a long drasha, so it feels like a Shabbos HaGadol. But I go back to that idea of Heshev Leivavos Abanim, Leivanim Alavosam, which is from that context, which we noted, as the Bodran writes, is probably the most likely reason why it's called Shabbos HaGadol, Hinei Anochi Shaleich Lachem. So that idea is also reflection of the fact that there is a, call it synergistic again, perhaps, but a influence that Leivavos Abanim, Leivanim Alavosam, that parents have on children and children have on parents, and that relates to what we talked about a few minutes ago about the idea of there being an overflowing chinuch effect, and that parents act a certain way, the children realize this, and then they act that way, and then hopefully they reinforce that environment, and parents act like that more, parents are even inspired themselves. So this notion of an ongoing synergistic chinuch is conveyed by that pasuk, and that's a powerful point in and of itself. So there's also a suggestion that maybe it's somewhat of a typo, that maybe since the Rama records that there's a minhag to read the Haggadah on Shabbos HaGadol, as a part of the anticipation of Pesach. So therefore, maybe it's really called Shabbos Haggadah, and that somehow kind of morphed into Shabbos Haggadah. But that also illustrates the fact that it's kedai to keep in mind the need to really be prepared for the Seder, both in terms of halachically and also in terms of the limud of the Seder experience, and to whatever extent we're able to prepare ourselves mentally. It's hard because it's a busy time of year and there's so much to do. I just came back from Eretz Yisrael, so talking to a lot of people there and mentioning that one advantage that we have in America of having two starim is that the only time you really have time to read the Haggadah is the second day of Yantif, or in anticipation of the second day of Yantif, and the afternoon of the first day, because so busy before the first Seder. So if you have a second Seder, so you have at least some time in the afternoon to look over the Haggadah. So it's hard. It's hard to make the time to be able to focus on the themes of the Seder and to really try to truly understand them. And so it takes a little bit of extra preparation and extra planning to be able to find that time. So the notion that this Shabbos is, in that sense as well, a Shabbos Haggadah, a Shabbos, a time when you can perhaps give that a little bit more understanding and a little bit more attention so that your Seder will be even more meaningful. So that's certainly something that you're going to want to try to do. Maybe mention one more idea which connects halachically and from a lamdisha perspective to a Parshas Tzav specifically. So being a Parshas Tzav, the Shabbos Haggadah, it's an opportunity to focus on that. There is a concept in halacha and in lamdis that is very, very relevant to Pesach. It is a Shas topic, it's a Kol Torah Kula topic, but it has specific relevance to Pesach in many different ways, and that's the sugya of Chatzi Shir. That there is a notion that even when the Torah connects certain averos, let's say, to a specific shir, so that doesn't mean that it's mutter if you don't reach that shir. There's still an isser called chatzi shir when encountering that isser on any level. So this is very relevant, for example, to chametz. When it comes to chametz, so there's an isser associated with kares if one eats a kezayis of chametz on Pesach, but that doesn't mean that it's mutter to have less than a kezayis of chametz on Pesach. That's a prohibition as well, and it may be an additional prohibition specifically on Pesach, because the Rambam's language is the topic of much discussion, that even though this is a concept of Kol Torah Kula, but the Rambam sounds like he has a special source for that regarding chametz. So the Shas topic of Chatzi Shir is specifically relevant when it comes to Pesach in that sense, and relevant to chametz. There's also a whole discussion regarding not just the eating of chametz, but the question of Vayira Vayimatze, and whether that has a shir, and if it does have a shir, is there a prohibition also in less than that of a chatzi shir that actually has huge halakhic ramifications, because it goes to the question of how thorough a search in your house do you have to do? What kind of Pesach cleaning do you have to do? If the chametz that you would find at that point is going to be less than the kezayis anyway, so it's a question whether there would be a applicability of Vayira Vayimatze if that was the focus of B'dikas chametz, which is also a discussion. So regarding the isurim of chametz, so there is certainly a lot of connection to that sugya and Pesach. But there's also another discussion regarding chatzi shir, which also is relevant to Pesach. And the Achronim bring up the question that should we say that when it comes to mitzvos, there's also a concept of chatzi shir. So just like we're going to say that there is some avera, even if it's not punishable, but there's some avera in having any chametz on Pesach, would we say that the opposite is also true? That when it comes to matzos, we know Pesach night is a time when shiurim take up a lot of our attention, shiurim in the sense of measurements, so, and shiurim of Torah also, but shiurim of measurements take up a lot of attention. So the notion of, let's say, having a kezayis of matzah, so let's say you were to have less than a kezayis of matzah, maybe that's all you have access to, or however the situation is. So is there any mitzvah in having less? So should we have a concept of chatzi shir by mitzvahs? So the Gemara talks about it in the context of averos, and the Achronim raises this question, the Avinezer, the Yitzchak, and many others, is there, the flip side, is there a chatzi shir by mitzvahs? So there are some who want to suggest that the question could be answered by looking at what seems to be a dual way of understanding a line in the Gemara. And this is itself an interesting clue that the Gemara has two possible sources for the concept of Chatzi Shir in general. We mentioned a minute ago the Rambam has his own source for Chametz, but the Gemara brings a different source for Chatzi Shir overall. And the Gemara says that there is a concept of Chatzi Shir from two possible sources. So one is a pasuk in Parshat Tzav. That's why we're saying it's relevant to this week's parsha. The pasuk of Kol Chelev. You shouldn't eat not just a kazayis of Chelev, but any part of the Chelev is a part of the prohibition. And then the Gemara also has the Svara. So the Svara is somewhat mysterious, and it's a topic of a lot of analysis. So first translated vaguely before trying to understand what it means beyond that. The Svara is Kevan Dechazi Litzderufe Yisura Ka'ochel. That, translating it vaguely, that since this is possible to combine with more, and then you will have a full shear, if you just increase the quantity of what you have without changing anything, but just increase the quantity, so then you will reach a level of punishment. So then this substance is aser. So dealing with, let's say, chazer or chametz, that even though you have less than a kazayis, but it's theoretically possible to combine it with more, so therefore any amount is aser. So what does that mean? How does that tell us anything? So we could suggest two ways to understand it, as the Acharonim discuss. That one way to understand it is that it's basically a siag min haTorah. That this is, albeit a din min haTorah, but maybe a safeguard, as we've spoken about a few times, there could be such a concept. And that maybe, really, the Isser only kicks in once you hit a kezayis. The Onesh and the Isser only kick in at a kezayis. But the Torah still prohibits having less, because you could call this the potato chip svara, that you can't have just one, so once you get started, you're going to continue, so maybe it's a safeguard against going actually past the threshold. So maybe it's just usher as a siag min haTorah. While the other understanding is more fundamental, and you could say that what it means is that it's not about the concern that you may finish your shiur, but it's reflective of something. That we're saying that the fact that the Torah prohibits chametz or chazer or whatever it is, and says that if you eat a certain amount, it's going to be an onesh. So what's the relationship of the shir to the onesh? Maybe the shir is just telling us that we need to have something quantifiable or something notable in order to be able to give an onesh, in order for it to be enforceable. But the fact that there's an onesh at all, the fact that you ever hit a certain point where there's an onesh, it means that this is something that is bad, that if it's below a certain threshold, so then it's not noticeable or it's not chashuv enough, and we're not going to act on it. But the fact that just increasing the quantity without changing anything else eventually gets you to a state of onesh, that shows you that this is bad, and that even when there's no onesh, so then it's still something to be avoided. So some suggest that maybe these two understandings of chazalitz trufe, that's relevant to the question of, is there chatzi shir by mitzvos? Because if the idea is that hitting a certain threshold means there's an onesh, tells us that this is bad, so that svar could be flipped also. You could say that when it comes to matzah, if hitting a certain threshold, hitting a kezayis of matzah, means that you officially fulfill a mitzvah, so then maybe that tells us that less than that is still good. It's not necessarily a mitzvah, but it tells you that, like, fulfillment of a mitzvah rather, but it tells us that this is a worthwhile activity, and keep going and you will be in fulfillment of a mitzvah. So therefore, this is a desirable activity. So I'm out of time. So if that's the idea, so then you could say that, yeah, that logic applies in both directions. It applies to averos, and also applies to mitzvos. So maybe we should have a concept of chatzi shir by mitzvos too. But if it's a siag min haTorah, so then that sounds like it's a concept that's really only relevant to averos, and doesn't necessarily have an application to mitzvos. But perhaps we could say that no, that maybe there also, there is such an idea that might be relevant to mitzvos, that yes, it's true, the siag concept sounds like it's more about averos, that we're afraid of the potato chip svara, that once you eat one, you're going to keep going. But there is a certain logic of that applies to mitzvos as well, that we recognize that an action tends to form a pattern and tends to lead to that action being repeated. And therefore, we are noting that even if this is not going to necessarily take us at the moment to the full fulfillment of the mitzvah, but taking a step in that direction is possibly going to create a path that will follow, and that, yes, it could lead to the fulfillment of the mitzvah in its complete sense. So maybe there is some kind of an inverse relationship there also, where you could say that the logic of a siag by averas does have a parallel when it comes to mitzvos, and taking a step in the right direction, even if it's not the full step, even if it doesn't take us all the way there, but is something that is very notable. And that is perhaps what we talk about when we aspire to godless. So we know that godless is an ongoing process, but every step in that direction is a tremendous thing. And therefore, as we look towards godless and we look towards growth, so any measure of growth is significant, even if we haven't reached the destination that seems so notable or seems so obvious. But taking a path in that direction is what creates the likelihood that we will go further in that path. So that notion of Shabbos HaGadol, the Shabbos when we are setting our sights on attainment and looking to grow, so every step in that direction is significant, even if we're not necessarily noticing and it doesn't necessarily seem like such a big deal at the time. Perhaps that's one connection from the parsha to the theme of Shabbos HaGadol. We'll also just make one more observation, because we spoke about chinuch before. So there is a discussion in the Rishonim about the mitzvah of chinuch. So we have a mitzvah, really, relate to it as a mitzvah midrabanan of chinuch, that children are supposed to do mitzvos even though they're not yet obligated in them. And there was a discussion in the Rishonim what that means, because if we're assuming this is a mitzvah derabanan, so how could it be that children have any obligation? Because children are pater from mitzvos in general, so the notion of observing dinim derabanan is a mitzvah. We talked about that this week, talked about it yesterday, I think, the mitzvah of lo sasu min hadavar, that one is obligated to follow the dictates of Chazal. So if you're not obligated in the mitzvahs of the Torah, so how are you going to be obligated in the mitzvahs of the Rabbanim? It's not going to be binding on children just like the rest of the Torah. So some of the Rishonim understand, actually, that chinuch is not a mitzvah on the children. And when we say that there's a mitzvah midrabanan for a child to do a mitzvah because of chinuch, it means there's a mitzvah on the parents. There's a mitzvah on the parents to train the children to do mitzvos, but it doesn't mean that the child himself has any obligation at all. But there are other Rishonim who do understand there to be an obligation on the children, has many nafkaminas for different purposes. So that prompts the question, so where could it come from? What is there that could obligate the child to do mitzvos if the child is pater from the commandments of the Torah as a whole? So how is he able to be obligated on any level if they don't have the commandments of the Torah binding on him? So perhaps it's actually a very similar svara to the idea of Chazal Tzrufei, and therefore maybe connects to the Parsha as well, that maybe the theme of that there's a certain understanding here that reaching an onesh means that you're doing something bad, or reaching a kiyum mitzvah means you're doing something good, even if you don't actually reach that threshold. So maybe that also could be the svara that obligates in chinuch, because essentially a child relating to mitzvahs is very similar to lechatz yishir, that just like you don't have an onesh for less than a shir, or a kiyum mitzvah for less than a shir, so too a child being that they're not yet subject to onshin and kiyum mitzvahs, they're not yet subject to obligations, but things that are good still are good for them, and things that are bad are still bad for them. So the same logic that tells us that if there's an onesh here when you reach a kezayis, so then even less than that is bad, could also be the svar of chinuch, saying that if when you reach 13 or 12, you're going to be obligated to do this action, so that shows you that this action is good. And conversely, if when you reach that age, there's going to be an onesh for doing a certain action, that shows us that that action is bad. So a child who is aware and is sensitive to this can realize that, okay, so I can see what's good and what's bad, and it makes sense to do good things and to avoid bad things. So that's also a part of the process towards godless, being able to anticipate and to recognize what it is that comes along with that, and that's part of this overall message, both of Shabbos HaGadol, that we aspire towards godless, and what that means for us in terms of attitudes and in terms of actions and in terms of preparation, and the notion of the synergistic relationship that is contained within chinuch, then chinuch goes in a few directions. Chinuch applies to ourselves. We are constantly working and refining and enhancing our own behavior. Chinuch is an obligation of parents towards their children. It's an obligation of children towards their parents. And as the Haftarah tells us, v'heishiv le'bavos albanim le'bavos al avosam, that is the Yom HaGadol that we anticipate, and that is the mindset that guides us the Shabbos as we await the full geula of Pesach. So we shall have a wonderful Shabbos. We'll see you on Sunday. We're volunteering for Nachah.